Welcome to episode 34 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. Our topic today is redesigning suburbs. I'm your host, Ellen Dunham-Jones, professor and director of the Master of Science in Urban Design at Georgia Tech. I'm joined today by David Dixon, vice president at Stantec, where he is the Urban Places Fellow. David, with Jason Besky, co-edited Suburban Remix, Creating the Next Generation of Urban Places, and is working with suburban communities across North America to chart new futures that respond to rapidly changing demographic, economic, environmental, and technological change. He works in cities as well as suburbs. David co-authored Design for an Urban Century, and Residential Architecture Magazine named David to their Hall of Fame as the person we call to ask about cities. Lots more awards, and I won't go into all of them, but he is particularly proud of leading New Orleans post-Katrina master plan. Now, the dichotomy between cities and suburbs is less and less meaningful distinction these days, as more and more North American suburbs are being redesigned to address these dramatic changes. This is also the focus of most of my research, and I'm delighted to get a chance to geek out with David about what these changes are and what's driving them. And I have lots of questions. I'm hoping that you will also post questions in the Q&A on Zoom, and we'll get to those after David and I finish our chat. So first, David, give us a little background to set the stage. What's your earliest memory of being interested in the design of neighborhoods?
My earliest memory actually comes from being about 5 years old, and I'm going to sound very, very old now, because my brother and I used to stare out the window of our house in the south side of Chicago, waiting for the milkman and his horse to come by so we could bring him an apple. And we'd bring the apple down, and the milkman would thank us on behalf of his horse, and then sort of tell us stories about other houses he'd stop by, people who'd given him cookies, etc. And it gave me a very warm sense of the potential for community in a neighborhood that has and now I'm going to jump way ahead, I later learned the density and the mix of people and activity to actually promote community and bring people together.
That's an awesome experience. I mean, and one that is certainly not happening in today's suburbs. We still have the occasional paper person. I mean, but that's about as close as it comes, kind of, I think. Now, you and I have a bunch of similarities. We are both urbanists who have co-authored, co-edited books on redesigning suburbs. Mm-hmm. I'm an academic and kind of looking at the issue from 35,000 feet, while you're a deeply experienced professional. But I think we agree, on why this is such a timely and absolutely an important thing to mm-hmm. be working on. Yet urbanists have held suburbia in disdain for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Why do you think urbanists, designers have not wanted to tackle suburbia?
Well, first of all, let me just say, I think the very same forces that are creating a new generation of urban opportunity, unprecedented urban opportunity, are creating actually pretty much the same opportunity in suburbs, where it has much more literal room to take flower, to really take form. Why have urbanists held suburbs in disdain? Because, and I'm going to use very purposely, we thought they were boring, people drove around in cars, they weren't diverse, they weren't all the virtues we extolled, many of which we learned from Jane Jacobs, about what made cities and mixed-use walkability great. We also sort of thought, it's kind of fun to be at the edge. You know, we're pioneers. We're advocating for something that I'm going to get worse and worse here. boy, will I sound disdainful. That are less educated and aware fellows simply don't understand. They don't know the richness of cities because they're stuck out in suburbs. And I can get much worse, but I'm going to stop myself.
Okay. Well, I can get worse. I mean, I've received tremendous pushback in academia. I was out and out told, if you're a true urbanist, you'd be studying downtowns. And basically, like the rest of my sort of male colleagues.
Yeah.
And I responded, you know, we aren't always doing everything we should in our downtowns, but the academics had already figured, and the professionals had really already, there were no more intellectual questions about what we should be doing in downtowns to the same degree that everybody was clueless about suburbia. You go into a library and an architecture school, rows and rows of books on downtowns, and then maybe a handful of books that are mostly just condemning suburbia, but nobody's like saying, what do you do now?
Yeah, or they were good housekeeping design books about suburbia.
Sorry. Exactly, yeah. So, you know, this urban-suburban divide,
yes,
it's pretty false, but it has been politicized for such a long time now, especially because so many suburbs are no longer Republican red. They're turning purple. And we can debate the chicken egg question here. Are they turning more Democratic in their voting because those suburbs are building more shared spaces, shared transit, more diverse housing types? Or are they allowing these kind of investments because their population is already more diverse and more egalitarian or more demanding of the shared? So I'm happy to hear your thoughts on that one, but also mostly, how do you avoid the politicization of urbanizing the suburbs in practice?
Okay, I'm going to talk about a very specific, I love this question, case in point, which is Sandy Springs, Georgia, not far from where we're sitting today. Sandy Springs is the most politically conservative community I have ever worked in. It basically became a city, in effect, but very much a suburb, because they were sending a lot of their white money to black parts of Fulton County and didn't feel that was fair. Anyway, long story short, they had a wonderful, wonderful mayor who led actually that effort, whose name I, of course, am now forgetting, who felt that Sandy Springs needed a heart. It was a town of ninth highest per capita income of any suburb in the U.S., probably, I assume, but just about one of the wealthiest, certainly around Atlanta. Lots of wonderful single-family homes, and she said, we now need a heart. And this was about 15 years ago, at most. She hired us. And this is where I learned the value of pragmatism, because Sandy Springs not only we began with a community, obviously, engagement effort and visioning effort, and we quickly realized that to simply tell people, gee, you need a dense, walkable, mixed-use downtown, got us precisely nowhere except without a job. But what if we talked to people about what they wanted in their lives today, which was walkability, it was community, it was places to come together, it was places to feel civic. We quickly could translate this into a downtown and then talk about what that meant. And a downtown started with enough life on the street to really make it a destination. So what does life on the street take? Well, it takes enough density of people living, in those days working, now pretty much living, within 5 minutes of a main street one might want to bring to life, to really say, honestly look people in the face and say, yes, we can bring this place to life. What we also were able to talk to them about, and these are bright folks who really listen, are the fundamental changes in our demographics and our economy that made this downtown not only a good idea, but a really smart and I'm going to come back to this word, pragmatic idea. So even at that point, one could look forward and see that from in those days, that was about, 10, 15 years ago, it was about 2010, for the next 30 years, that the large majority, at this point it's about 80%+ of net new households, that is the housing market. The housing market is 2/3, I'll make a bigger gesture here, of our real estate market are going to be single, we're then going to be, are still going to be singles and couples without kids. Net new households are the housing market. Again, housing market is 2/3 of our real estate economy. Where folks want to live represents the future of our community, shapes our communities. Well, where do folks without kids tend to want to live? In mixed-use, walkable places. It could be the suburbs. It could be the city, depending on who they are and lots of other things. But they don't. They're not looking for big single-family houses on single-family lots. What Sandy Springs folks did was look around at themselves. I remember asking them, how many of you, at one point in the audience, how many of you intend to have kids in the next 10 years? And finally had to beg somebody to raise a hand because you need kids. And then how many of you might move in the next 10 years? Lots of hands went up and people looked around and suddenly saw a new reality. So they then began, and I'm going to use the word pragmatic again, not only did they realize it wasn't just them who wanted a downtown, but many of their neighbors. But also, frankly, if they wanted to sell these single-family houses, if they wanted to maintain the value of Sandy Springs as a community, they needed to be Sandy Springs with a whole new dimension, with a heart. And that's what Eva was the mayor's first name. Yeah. I'll remember her last name.
Galambos.
Galambos, thank you. She is one of my personal heroes. Now, Sandy Springs was so conservative that the night that city council approved the plan, there were about 40 of us at a very long table and having dinner, and Eva looked down the table and said, and this was the night before, I think, the Obama II election, so that's even earlier than I thought. She looked down the table and said, poor David, you're the only D in the room. And you can guess what she meant. It was not Republican. She then went on to say, we've all learned the values we share. Sandy Springs went on to use eminent domain, not something they would ever envisioned, to create City Springs. They also chose to call it City Springs. They also, for the first time in the most recent, I forgot what you call it, but retail tax override to support transit, supported the override after years of opposing it, because they found out that a lot of the folks who wanted to come live in Sandy Springs were folks who did not want to have to depend on a car. And I'm going to stop there because I can see my dear colleague here looking at a long list of questions. But is this fair? Is this getting the point across?
Okay. Oh, it's a fabulous start.
And I would say probably most of the suburbs I've worked in have voted for Republican candidates for president, invested hundreds of millions of public dollars, used eminent domain, and other very governmentally proactive steps to achieve what their community valued, and with the understanding that these were good investments. And now, yes.
Well, I think you also, I love that, and I really have watched that one closely, and yeah. I love that it was mostly, they built their downtown on a dead Target anchored
exactly.
strip mall.
Yeah,
I mean, you know,
yep,
and
exactly.
a bunch of other properties,
yeah,
but
yeah.
still. And they're expanding it now,
yeah, yes. so,
which is also
yeah.
great. You know, well, the practical arguments, I know you also, and the pragmatism is something that you also emphasized when you spoke to my students in
yeah.
my retrofitting
yeah.
suburbia class and gave
yeah.
a great lecture, which I'm going to also, we're going to post on the website, and I also encourage listeners to watch to be able to see some of the slides. And in that one, the emphasis of the lecture was really on how the suburbs are competing for jobs.
Yes.
And you talked a lot about Kanata North, so tell
yeah.
us a little.
Okay. Some of you may remember a film called Spider-Man. Spider-Man is famous for saying, with great power comes great responsibility. Well, suburbs have a great deal of power in determining the future of their regions, say, the opportunity that will come to their regions, because they have land. They have failing shopping malls. I spent an hour with a client earlier talking about one in Connecticut. We're working on one outside of Nashville right now. The list goes very on. One particular suburban area I've been working in is a place called Kanata North, which is outside of Ottawa. Kanata North is the largest innovation cluster in Canada, and it was developed on what was an industrial park, became an office park, migrated to a tech park, and tech parks have become increasingly innovation because it is less the products that are developed than the ideas behind those products and the software that runs them that is become really important and where jobs and investment are being created. So, long story short, Kanata North is hugely important to the economic future of Ottawa, but that translates into the personal economic opportunity of folks who live in Ottawa. So, fast forward. We were brought in because the good companies, and these are globally recognized companies, in Kanata North were beginning to worry they were going to have to move to Seattle, to San Francisco, to places where they could find workforce. And this has to do with the fact that going forward, also for the next 20 years, let's say at this point, probably 90%+ of net new jobs, that's job creation, will require some higher education, because almost all these jobs are in knowledge industries, but particularly the innovation cutting edge that creates the ideas that then power knowledge industries and most of our economy. This is where economic growth comes from. At the same time, fewer kids, guess what's happening to our workforce? Without immigration, the U.S. would already have a shrinking workforce. I don't mean to get into politics again, but think about, there's another country called Japan that's been experiencing that for a while. A much slower growing workforce is happening at the same time that jobs are now concentrating in folks, around folks who have some higher education. This is where the growth part of our, this is where jobs are growing, as I just said. Tremendous shortage of these folks. These folks do not follow jobs anymore. Jobs and investment follow them. Where do they want to go? To mixed use, walkable, the same places that our housing economy wants to build, whether they're in suburbs or in cities. Fast forward. Kanata North has the same unprecedented opportunity that downtown Atlanta or downtown Ottawa has, this unprecedented housing market seeking to build community-rich, walkable, highly amenitized places with the multifamily housing that will create the density that will really bring these places to life. What I often talk about, and was talking about yesterday to some folks in Atlanta, is that when we look at particularly our innovation economy, which is what really drives growth, it is much now less about companies or even, it's more about districts. It's about ecosystems. It's not do we create companies that will attract workforce to come and work for our companies, and we'll get into hybrid work in a minute. It is, are we creating the ecosystems where these people live, work, play, learn, etc., run into each other, and therefore create a really competitive innovation economy and really spur growth? And is this enough of an answer?
Okay. I think that's fabulous. Okay. And I love that Kanata North, as a Canadian example, gets us a little bit outside of the U.S.
Yeah.
Your book with Jason, Suburban Remix, includes several more international examples. June Williamson and I, in our work, really were very much kind of mostly U.S. focused. And I've argued that while suburbs look very different around the globe, they're all facing the same challenges: reducing car dependency, climate change, equity, public health, and in many, but not all places, the aging society, as you just talked about. What do you see happening in terms of redesigning existing suburbs around the world?
Okay, so I'm going to actually restrict myself to the developed world, mm-hmm. which has a tremendous amount. Actually, I was just asked by my dear company to go give a talk to our clients in London. And I thought, there's a bit of a cultural misfit here. But boy, did we have a lively discussion, because they're facing the same thing. An aging society, a demographics, and a changing housing market that is much more urban, whether it takes place in suburbs or cities, etc. But long story short, they are also facing a labor shortage. In fact, the entire developed world, Japan is sort of the pinnacle of this, is facing a labor shortage. Canada, with much more robust immigration, is facing a labor shortage, much more robust than we have. And boy, are we facing a severe one. So long story short, what is needed around the developed world are places that invite diverse people to come and share a sense of community because they live, walk, play, learn, would recreate, etc. Ideally, and I'm going to be very specific here, probably within a 5-minute walk. That's a quarter mile, 400 meters of each other, because that's how most people and how far most people in most countries turn out to walk, despite some of our self-image here, not mine, but. So the ability to create these dense, compact, critical mass, really highly amenitized with, and amenitized meaning uses that encourage people to interact, are increasingly critical, essential to economic development across the developed world. And let me tell you, I'm going to jump very quickly to the impact of hybrid work in the pandemic. In fact, the pandemic did not invent hybrid work. Office absorption in this country compared to 2000 is down by about 50%, evening out for the pandemic over the last 20 some odd years, because hybrid work, the pandemic accelerated hybrid work. I was asking innovation R&D and HR directors, particularly at Canada North, well, why do you care that much about the place-based planning that we're doing and Ellen talks about so much and does so and so eloquently? And they said, it's a no-brainer, Dixon. If our workforce isn't here in the workplace, we want them living within 5 minutes of where they work or and of each other. And there were two very important reasons here. One, it turns out that folks who live near where they work and show up at the workplace are much more likely to continue to work for the same company. And when you're out there competing for talent, that really matters. But two, and maybe even more important, is the ability to promote, and I'll use the term because it's the term of art, creative collisions. Unplanned meetings, and Brookings Institution has suggested between people who work for different companies, and if any of you can figure out how to do an unplanned Zoom call, please let us know. Unplanned meetings, people who work for different companies, that turn out to be the real spur. There's a term I am lacking here, but I'll describe it in a minute, for the innovation economy. If you think of the innovation economy as a very large funnel in which you need a real velocity of ideas coming in at the large end of the funnel so that they can be analyzed and developed and turned into a trickle of commercialized products at the other end, if you turn off that velocity at this end, pretty soon you turn off the trickle at the other end. What has really slowed the innovation economy in recent years, well, it hasn't slowed so much, is the biggest concern is it will slow in a few years because the pandemic turned off the creative collisions that were fueling you can't fuel a funnel, but you know, introducing the ideas, the flow at the wide end of the funnel that will be so necessary in a couple of years. And the good folks at Canada North said, looking forward, if folks are not going to be in the office for whatever reason, pandemic or simply lifestyle changes, we want them in this. And that's where I actually began to use personally and now with more and more clients the term innovation ecosystem. We need an ecosystem, not a company. Is this getting at your question?
Absolutely. And I have so many more questions, yeah. But I do want to get soon to the questions online. So mm-hmm. I encourage folks mm-hmm. who are listening in, if you've got questions, put them in the Q&A, and hopefully we'll get to them. Mm-hmm. You know, but part of that ecosystem you've talked about before as being, you know, the authenticity that comes from having the chefs, the artists, the performers, the folks who are the living culture of a community.
Yeah.
But it's expensive. Redevelopment is expensive.
Yeah.
How do we both provide a living culture that helps to support, is part of that ecosystem of innovation, and yet also provides for equitable, affordable housing for everybody?
Well, we just talked, Ellen doesn't know this, but she just brought up two very big issues. So, okay, I'm going to start with living culture. And really, thank you. I appreciate you bringing this up. All your questions are great. So you can go out and invest. I had a client in Tampa who creating a development called Water Street, which ultimately will be 9 million square feet. It'll be the new downtown for Tampa, but we worked with him in an earlier stage. And one of the things that I really learned from him was how important it was to bring in the living culture of Tampa, the best chefs, the best makers, performers, etc., to find the space that where they could live, which means subsidized housing, long-term affordable housing, perform, bake, whatever they did make, in the heart of and throughout the fabric of Water Street, because he's going to invest $3 billion probably over the next 20 years, a lot of it Bill Gates money, but somebody else can invest $3 billion 10 years later and outcompete him in an instant. But if Water Street becomes old, and anything we build starts becoming old the minute we finish building it, it's no longer trendy 5 years later, etc. But long story short, if our living culture is embedded throughout it, it is new every day, because the arts is new every day, whether it's performance or baking or making or whatever. And we have learned I personally learned, and certainly that in all the work we have done since then, that it's not hard to make the economic case for, in fact, I'm going to add one piece to this in a minute, for living culture, because it creates not only initial value, but enduring value. Now, I'm going to jump to a project we're working on in Southeast Nashville, Global Mall, another failed mall, which is emerging as an arts and innovation district. It turns out that, we've done this elsewhere also, but there are a lot of artists who need long-term affordable housing. If you can concentrate it, you can bring a genuine arts district to life, and one that will be new. It won't become a museum of itself in 10 years, because artists are always creating, craving what is new, discovering from each other, etc. They will self-program and all sorts of wonderful things. Boy, are they good at then attracting lots of other people who want to come and not just visit, and but live, work, play nearby, because a place becomes cool. So they are a great way to attract the talent I was talking about, and to create the kind of lively environment that promotes the creative collisions I was talking about. There is just a fundamental synergy. But now I want to talk about equity, because this is there's something equitable about creating artist housing. As many of you may be thinking, gee, that guy's talking about a lot of highly paid jobs, etc., and I have been. One of the things that a knowledge economy, and particularly innovation economy, does is pay for scarce talent. They pay a lot for it because they're competing for it. So since 1970, probably a majority of us in real dollar terms are a little less well off than we were. Top 10% of us are a lot more well off, and you know, you can go up from there, because the knowledge industry largely has rewarded us, not us in this case, but others who bring their skill and their creativity to this work. Talked about labor shortage. As everybody on this call knows, there are a lot of folks locked out of our workforce. You can dangle a job or an opportunity in front of a parent with a single parent with a child all you want, and without robust daycare, doesn't do you or them any good.
Thank you.
If somebody has a prison, I did the post-Katrina plan for New Orleans. New Orleans prided itself on incarcerating more adult men, you can guess what race they tended to be, per capita than any other city in the U.S., tough on crime. They're going to make a difference. What they did in the process was produce more adult men per capita who could never get a job for the rest of their natural lives, because if you have a prison record and somebody doesn't cure it, you can't get a job. If you don't have a regular doctor and just get sick unexpectedly, as opposed to scheduled doctor's appointments with your employer, you're a lot harder employed. The list goes on and on. So we have a labor shortage. We need to really invest in robust workforce readiness before we get to skills, things that bring people across the bridge that is separating, that is leaving them out of the new economy into it, and then provide the skills. And this is not just the right thing to do, it is a fundamentally pragmatic thing to do, to get back to that word, because this is the same as attracting talent to these lively, cool neighborhoods. Actually, when these folks become educated, they tend to want to stay in the same places, I will say. But it is yet another way to build the talent supply, which then attracts jobs and investment.
Fantastic. All right. My last question is, you know, we've been talking about all the, you've sharing all these great strategies and the success strategies, but we've all seen fabulous urban design proposals that for one reason or another never got implemented. What advice do you have for suburban community leaders, planners, developers, to help them achieve their goals and actually get built projects? I mean, you've got to have had some disappointments.
Yes, I had one this morning. Okay, I'm sorry. Communities have a very hard time talking about housing for a mall when housing is 2/3 of the real estate economy. But fast forward, I'm going to suggest two very specific things. One is get the density right. I like to use the term walkable density. 1,000 net new housing units within a 5-minute walk will bring a block of Main Street to life. If you can't bring that block of Main Street to life, you won't get the housing. It's a chicken and egg. You won't get jobs. You won't get all kinds of investment because it is amenity that drives the ability to attract people, jobs, and investment. So if you can program a new suburban center with sufficient density, and I'm not talking about towers, I'm talking about a mix of anything from 5 to 7-story buildings over housing over retail down to townhouses and row houses, and I could even go a little bit less, but I'm going to make myself nervous if I suggest that. Within 5 minutes, close into the center, it will come to life. And I was at a conference again yesterday called Metropolitan Area Regional Symposium. I gave a talk, but more got to listen to project after project that was working around this formula. We did a plan for a new village center outside of Boston on a Kresge, former Marshall site, excuse me. And until the client got close to 1,000 units, we couldn't get a retail recruiter to show up because they said it would be a failed effort. Close to 1,000, it's coming to life. Great Main Street. The other piece of this is prudent public investment. Nice term is public-private partnerships, but it's actually public investing in private. Did a lot of work in Dublin, Ohio, place very much like Sandy Springs, which ended up investing about $300 million of public money, tax increment financing, to ultimately generate more than $1 billion of private development in a new mixed-use walkable downtown that is paying very rich dividends to Dublin. But time and again, what you have to do is not just when you create these places, particularly in suburbs, you are transforming malls, single-use shopping centers, places that are fundamentally auto-centric in terms of everything about them, and you have to create the infrastructure of walkability. You have to, in some cases, allow them to subsidize retail rents until places can take off. But that retail is really necessary to rent the 4 or 5 floors above and get other people to show up and things like that. I have never yet found a community that regretted that investment. Or if you're Sandy Springs, build a regional performing arts center, among other things, as in a way a subsidy, an amenity. Does that get at your question?
That certainly does. All right. Do we have some questions in the Zoom? I'm gonna, Anu, why don't you come on over and maybe, if you want to share your laptop to me, I can see them on here.
Make sure all the questions, I was gonna say, send all the questions to Ellen.
Okay, so if I just go down to Q&A. There we go, we've got 4 questions. All right, okay. Stephen LaPierre asks, what is the most effective way to get policymakers on board with adding housing and commercial density in suburban communities? As a commercial real estate broker, I see many communities with a NIMBY attitude towards allowing mixed-use development because of the perception that it will greatly increase traffic and affordable housing will bring in undesirable types into the community.
So first, it's a great question and one I deal with repeatedly in the work we do, including the example in Nashville I mentioned and long list. And I think one of the things we have to remember is policymakers are often appointed, they're city staff, and they work for folks who get elected. And if those folks aren't going to get reelected, those policy folks are not going to be able to make the kind of policy that we might hope for or is actually rational in their self-interest. So I mentioned Dublin, Ohio. We spent a year visioning with the most affluent suburb in the Midwest, designed, built, and planned around a series of wonderful golf courses, but led by a city manager who said golf courses are not our future. It's a suburban walkable mixed-use downtown. It's been hugely successful. Just actually chosen as top place to live in the Midwest by one of the rating folks who went out and do that. But fast forward, this year was all about community education, not us lecturing to them, very much mutual. So that we could say, oh, here's the kind of community you want, here's how to achieve it. Now, that plus just a lot of hard data and really credible data. So, mentioned what's really driving housing demand and community formation is singles and couples without kids. They dominate the market. Guess what? They don't have kids, they don't bring kids, and therefore the expense of providing educations. In fact, our research shows that per square foot, or by any measure, that a new multifamily housing building is a much better fiscal deal than a multifamily office building in a suburban setting in this day and age, because office is a beleaguered market. And again, already was becoming increasingly challenged long before the pandemic. Housing, you are building into demand, toward demand, but it is educating kids that is the major fiscal cost associated with housing. It's not hard to hire a good traffic consultant to project traffic, show what it is, how much of it there is that's going to show up, when it's going to show up, where it's going to go, and invariably it is far less than the uses that used to occupy a site, particularly if they were retail and or office, and that's generally what occupied these sites. And I hope this is helpful, but it's all about education and data and doing the bits of research around the particular challenges that people raise and spending some time with them.
Absolutely. You mentioned so much, the office parks and the defunct retail sites, and certainly that's where most of the suburban retrofits are. I'm often asked, well, what about residential neighborhoods and properties? And there are a handful. I know some in Sandy Springs. There was a neighborhood that self-organized and that it kind of said, all right, developers are all knocking on our doors.
Yes. Yeah.
And we're going to self-organize for a higher price. And occasionally things like that happen. But do you see any examples of ways in which existing residential neighborhoods are actually, whether it's allowing the accessory dwelling units or allowing duplexes and quads or have you been involved in any planning with the existing residential neighborhoods?
Okay, I would say in some cases, much more limited, but I will say most frequently, and to my surprise, something that has, again and again, won support is accessory dwelling units, allowing people to add sometimes even more than one unit by converting their garage, building a unit into their house, etc. And how should I say it? The real test is, can people tell when they drive down the street? Maybe they can tell, but does it still feel like the neighborhood we initially bought into? And we have to remember, most houses in the U.S., suburban houses, were bought by families with kids. They are now owned by families without kids, increasingly who are getting older. When you get older at some point, I hate to tell you this, you move from a income that rises over time to a fixed income, and you become really interested in other ways to generate income. And if you want to stay in your neighborhood, an accessory dwelling unit is a terrific idea. If you want your kids to be able to move into your neighborhood, an accessory dwelling unit is a terrific idea. But I think what more and more neighborhoods are finding out is when they go talk to other folks who live in neighborhoods that have a lot of accessory dwelling units, it is, if anything, enhanced quality of life. There are more interesting people who show up. There are graduate students who come to block parties and things like that.
And they can support more restaurants and yes. support more of the creative.
Yeah. Other than that, infill development can be tricky. I find development that doesn't touch a blade of grass in anybody's front yard is much easier than something that's perceived to have an actual immediate impact. A nearby strip development that's clearly failing. We did something in Bloomington, Minnesota, to transform an arterial street back into a main street that basically meant redeveloping most of the strip development that appeared at, you know, five floor, you know, mixed use development, housing over retail, literally, you know, across an alley from single family houses. That worked. Moving that development in across that half block was a lot tougher.
Yeah. So, last question, David.
Sure.
What advice do you have for the next generation of urban designers? Those who are in school right now, what do you think they need to do? They need to be focused on new technologies and how AV shuttles and, I don't know, e-bikes are going to be. I think the aging boomers,
yeah,
we're
yes,
going to want
yeah.
not wheelchairs, but like motorcycle versions.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I don't know. What yeah. should the next generation, okay. what do they need to be thinking about?
Well, they need to be kind to us and about all the mistakes that our generation is probably continuing to make. So let me just, with a note of humility. But I would say more than anything specific, learn to be multidisciplinary thinkers. Think at the same time about what is the market telling us, what are fiscal impacts telling us, what do concerns around equity tell us, what is the environment telling us, what is changing technology tell us, and probably a longer list than this. What does authenticity mean? And it's not looking like somebody built 50 years ago. It's bringing the living culture of a community. How many factors can you bring together to create a truly rich interdisciplinary solution, plan, design, idea, urban design, you're much more likely to really enrich the quality of life and opportunity and touch the heart of the community you're working with than if you pursue what you're doing from any single, and I'm going to suggest particularly initially design-driven approach. Understand the underlying factors and let design grow from that, from those.
Excellent advice. Thank you, David. Thank you, listeners. You've been listening to episode 34 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech, a podcast of this event and a video of the lecture that David gave to my Retrofitting Suburbia class in the spring, with much more interesting slides than the view that the listeners today have had of just David and I here in the podcast booth. The podcast and the video will be posted to the Redesigning Cities website, where you can also check out previous episodes. Thank you, David.
Thank you, and thank you.